يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. Now, it's been a very long time. I was speculating 3 weeks since we'd last done a Middle East Analysis. And just like Ryanair, when you touch down, there really should be trumpets on arrival for this, I think, because it's been nearly 6 weeks. And
wow.
I know, it's a big catch-up. That wow came from, unsurprisingly, our regular studio guest, the world-famous Dr. Harry Hagopian, which is at Harry Hagopian on Twitter. I am at pains to point out at this point. We'll probably remind you of that later. Harry is the Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East North Africa region. Harry, fantastic to see you after so long.
Likewise. Even I hadn't realized that it's been 6 weeks, James, and 6 weeks is really an eternity in the political realities of the Middle East and North Africa these days.
Well, we say that, don't we? But, you know, approximately 1.5 million things have happened since we last spoke of note. Can we start, before we do a look around the entire region and pick at some of those very important points that we shall do so in the second part of this programme, can we look at Syria?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's start with Syria. And before we talk about Kofi Annan and the West's involvement and the situation of 70 plus people dying a day, which seems to not be mentioned so much anymore.
That's a cynical way of putting it, James, but I see where you're going with it.
A little cynical after 6 weeks, isn't it? But let's start with the piece of news that the Syrian ambassador in Iraq, Nawaf Faris, has actually resigned and made quite a strong point on exit, as it were.
He did make quite a strong point on exit in his statement that was transmitted on Al Jazeera. I think the resignation or the defection, call it what you will, of Ambassador Nawaf Faris was very, very important. He is a very important big Sunni man within the Syrian establishment. And I would say that he, as a former ambassador in Iraq, is probably as important as the Syrian ambassador in Lebanon when we take the whole region and look at their backgrounds. Now, Nawaf Faris comes from the security and intelligence establishment of Syria. So he's not just an ambassador or a diplomat there shaking hands and going to receptions and conveying messages to Damascus, but he was somebody who was intimately related to the intelligence and security networks of Syria, and therefore he has many files, he has much knowledge of what was happening and is still happening in Syria, and therefore it would be vital for the protest movement in Syria, for the West, for other friends of Syria, as they're called these days, to know a little bit more intimately as to what's happening in the inner circle of the Syrian establishment headed by President Bashar al-Assad. But, James, there is also another issue with Ambassador Nawaf Faris, that he's also the head of the Uqaydat tribe. Now, this is an important tribe that straddles the Syrian-Iraqi border. And the fact that the head of this tribe has decided so loudly and so vocally to defect and leave his post as ambassador because of what is happening on the ground sends signals to the world community that there is some sort of a steady drip of defections happening. We had last week the defection or the exit of another important military man, Brigadier General Manaf Atlas, whose father was very well known in Syria. He's now in France. We've had other defections as well from within the army, from within the political establishment. What this means that is that despite the fact that the Syrian establishment and government and presidency is so insulated from the outside world, yet there are things happening, ructions are appearing, and this could show the way perhaps forward in the future.
Now, President Bashar al-Assad has has tried to keep it tight, hasn't he? He doesn't want signs of dissent. It doesn't play out well in his strategy, if you like, to tough it out, does it?
Of course not. It doesn't. I mean, for him, the thing he doesn't want to show is that there is no unity around him and around the establishment, that the army is as impregnable as ever, and that the world community cannot really affect what is happening, because until today, the Syrian regime considers that all those who are fighting against him are basically terrorists. And he always points the finger at the West, who are trying to get rid of him. And he has the backing, of course, on the one hand of Russia and on the other hand of Iran. So all attempts that the West is doing at the United Nations or elsewhere in the international arena to try and exert some more pressure on him for a transition that would lead to a different kind of governance in Syria is being checkmated either by Russia and Iran on the one hand, or by the army that is still pounding towns, villages and cities across the whole country.
Now, we've talked about Syria's neighbours, specifically Lebanon, and also, of course, we've talked a bit about Turkey. Talking about Iraq then, bearing in mind that Nawaf Faris was the ambassador to Iraq, what are relations like between Iraq and Syria, particularly in light of, obviously, Iraq being a neighbour of Iran?
Well, the relations with Iraq are quite tricky because Iraq itself finds its position tricky in the sense that on the one hand, Iran has a very, very strong influence on Iraq itself and on Iraqi politics. And therefore, Iran being such a close supporter and friend of the Syrian regime would inevitably color some of the positions of the Iraqi government headed by Nouri al-Maliki. But also on the other hand, Iraq, I think, is very conscious of its role as an important and great Arab country within the Arab League. And therefore, what Iraq has done is pretty much try to sit on the fence and neither be fully supportive of the protests nor fully supportive of the regime in the hope that it can please all parties. My own experience throughout many, many years of political negotiations is that if you try to please everyone, sometimes you end up pleasing none.
Let's look at that a little bit more. You've got al-Maliki, who you could argue was, as a result of prolonged Western involvement in Iraq, came out as the leader there. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, the West is pushing to remove Bashar al-Assad. Mm-hmm. Could there be any comparison that it would then be a sort of Western-approved leader in Syria, and that's what everyone's worried about?
I don't think it could be a Western-approved leader in Syria. I think this whole idea that the West can actually change regimes in the way it did during colonial times, I don't think it still has much weight these days. I mean, look around you. Look at Egypt. Look at Libya. Look at Tunisia. Look at Yemen. Those are countries where the West has very important economic interests, military interests, strategic interests, and yet it doesn't have the people at the head that it would necessarily wish to have there. I think what we are seeing is a political catharsis, is a kind of movement within the whole region that is primarily led by the citizens of this region who are trying to reclaim, or for that matter claim, since some of them have never known what citizenship means, their citizenship rights. And those citizenship rights are not only political in nature. I don't know if our listeners are aware, but the Foreign and Commonwealth Office here in London came up with their FCO 2011 report this week called Human Rights and Democracy, where it basically points out that all those protests, revolutions, uprisings in the MENA region are not all a result of only people wanting citizenship rights and political rights, but a lot of them also come from economic needs and social justice. So put all those together and we have a reality where the people are dictating their claims, are dictating their needs, and in some cases are succeeding in doing so. What the West is doing is trying to help, of course, nourished by its own interests, just as Iran, just as Russia, just as everybody else is trying to do that as well. Given the shifting sands of the Middle East and North Africa, it tends to get a little bit dangerous when there is so much fighting going on in the region for interests, because the region is in some sense artificial, and that in itself could be a little bit dangerous.
Harry, let's conclude this segment on Syria by looking, you know, it's the classic what next question, particularly when we look at Special Envoy Kofi Annan and the plan, the six-point plan that we discussed over a great many podcasts. Now, I think, you know, it'd be tempting to say completely dead in the water, but other things are being investigated at the UN, such as allying it with Chapter 7, which might allow for further sanctions. You know better than I. Tell me a bit about that.
James, in all the interviews I've done and in the pieces that I've written on the Middle East and North Africa with specific reference to Syria, I've often said that the Kofi Annan six-point plan distinguishes itself by its non-implementation on the ground rather than by its implementation. There are 6 points, of which one of the clearest is a withdrawal of all the military, the tanks, the army, etc., from the streets of all these places, Homs, Hama, Deir ez-Zor, Dara, whatever. And this is not happening clearly. I think Kofi Annan is trying desperately to make his plan work. Now, is he doing that because he wants a mention in the history books in the future? Is he doing it because he's so convinced by what he's doing? I'm not too sure. But there are attempts taking place at the moment by the West, led by the United Kingdom, but with the support of Germany, France, the United States, and others, to pass another resolution at the United Nations, which would basically link Kofi Annan's plan to Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter. And that would mean that giving the monitors another 45 days, extending their mandate in the country, but so long as there is a very clear evidence of a cessation of violence and the withdrawal of the military, and that has to be done within the first 10 days to show good faith and goodwill by the regime. If it doesn't do that, then there are different articles, for instance, Article 41 of Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which empowers more economic and tough sanctions, which aren't necessarily military sanctions.
Now, that leaves us with question marks, and we'll try and answer those on further podcasts, most certainly. For part one, Dr. Harry Hagopian, at Harry Hagopian on Twitter, for all of you out there using Twitter, thank you very much for that. Part two, I'd like us to open up by talking a bit more about Libya and about Egypt. We'll focus on presidential elections and what that might mean, what it might mean for the Christians as well. I will make sure I get that question in nice and early. But for part one, Harry Hagopian, thank you very much.
Thank you.